Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good day, and welcome to the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation web briefing for journalists, Marketplace Open Enrollment in the Trump Era conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Greg Pawlowski. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us for the web briefing for reporters today. I'm Greg Pawlowski, the Foundation's Communications Director. Today, we plan to focus on what consumers should know as we head into the Affordable Care Act's first open enrollment period under the Trump administration. There is a lot that is the same or similar to past years, but also a lot that is new and different. To help us sort through this, we are joined by three of our top policy experts: Larry Levitt, who is a KFF Senior Vice President, Jennifer Tolbert, who is Director of State Health Reform, and Karen Politz, who is a Senior Fellow. Larry, Jen, and Karen will provide a brief overview of what to expect for the upcoming 2018 open enrollment period. When they finish, we will take your questions via web chat. You can type your questions in at any time, and asking early probably means we'll get to it earlier. You should also be aware that today's briefing is being recorded. We'll notify everyone who RSVP'd when the recording and slides are available online. With that, I'll turn it over to Larry, who will get us started with the presentation.
Thanks, Craig. I want to start by providing some context of the administrative actions and congressional debate that helps explain some of the chaos and confusion that we may see in the upcoming open enrollment period. One important fact is that the individual insurance market has been stabilizing. Insurers lost a lot of money in the individual market in the first couple years of the ACA, but there's been a dramatic turnaround this year, with most insurers, as premiums rose significantly, earning a profit in this market. Now, that, of course, could be undone by administrative actions that could undermine the marketplaces. At a minimum, these actions could create enormous confusion for consumers. The president issued an executive order recently in October calling for an expansion of less regulated insurance plans. Two main pieces of that executive order included calls for an expansion of association plans that would provide coverage for small businesses exempt from many of the ACA rules that now apply. And it also called for an expansion of loosely regulated short-term insurance plans, which are now limited to 3 months and could be expanded to 12 months. These short-term plans also are exempt from, in fact, all of the ACA rules and consumer protections. Neither of these steps will directly affect 2018 open enrollment, which begins in a couple weeks, but they could have an indirect effect by creating confusion for consumers. Another important action by the Trump administration has been to reduce resources for outreach and consumer assistance. The administration reduced federal funding for advertising by 90%, and reduced grants to navigators, which provide assistance to consumers during open enrollment and after, by 41%, with differing effects across states and programs. And most recently, and potentially most significantly, the administration terminated so-called cost-sharing subsidy payments to insurers. The most important takeaway for consumers is that insurers are still required by law to provide reduced deductibles and copays for low-income marketplace enrollees. And the second most important takeaway for consumers is that while insurers are increasing premiums to offset the loss of payments from the federal government, consumers will be mostly held harmless. Now, it's important to understand how these cost-sharing subsidy reductions work, both for consumers and for the debate over the termination of the funding for them. Cost-sharing subsidies or cost-sharing reductions are available to eligible individuals in the marketplace with incomes from 100 to 250% of the poverty level. Nationwide, about 57% of marketplace enrollees are eligible for this reduced cost-sharing, but that differs by state, notably by whether states have expanded Medicaid under the ACA or not. In states that have not expanded Medicaid, there are a substantial number of marketplace enrollees between 100 and 138% of the poverty level who would otherwise be in Medicaid. And so on average, about two-thirds of marketplace enrollees had cost-sharing reductions in 2017 in these states that did not expand Medicaid. These cost-sharing reductions are only delivered through silver plans in the marketplaces, which becomes important as we see how insurers have responded to the termination of these payments. Most insurers did anticipate this change as they worked on their premiums for 2018 and have raised 2018 premiums significantly, particularly for silver plans. President Trump's announcement last week ended the payments to health insurers, but as I mentioned, insurers are still required to offer the reduced cost sharing to eligible individuals. Now, just to give you a sense, a tangible sense of what these reduced cost sharing levels mean, we looked at average deductibles in standard silver plans and in the reduced cost sharing plans available to low-income enrollees. And as you can see here, if you look at the combined medical and prescription drug deductible in a standard silver plan, that averages about $3,600 per person in standard silver plans. But for the lowest income enrollees in the marketplaces, that's reduced to an average of $255. So these cost sharing reductions are quite meaningful for low income consumers. Now, looking at how states have approached the uncertainty around the termination of the subsidies and now the certainty of the termination of the payments, there are four main approaches states have taken. Most states allowed insurers to increase premiums for silver plans, and that's because the reduced cost sharing is only available in these silver plans, so that's where the premium increases are focused. Some states went further and allowed increases in premiums only for silver plans that are offered through the marketplace. And again, the logic of that is that the only marketplace plans have to offer this reduced cost sharing, so there would not be any premium increases for any plans offered outside of the marketplace. A few states directed insurers to increase premiums across the board throughout the individual market, which would affect premiums both inside and outside the marketplace, and all levels of plans, bronze, silver, gold, and platinum where available. And at least one state has not allowed any increases in premiums at all tied to the termination of cost-sharing subsidy payments. Now, to give you a sense of the magnitude of the premium increases we're looking at, this is an analysis we did back in April anticipating the possible termination of the cost-sharing subsidy payments. And we looked at how much silver plans in the marketplaces the premiums for silver plans in the marketplaces would have to increase to account for the end of cost-sharing subsidy payments. On average, premiums, we estimated that premiums would have to go up by 19%, but because of the different types of enrollees in Medicaid expansion versus non-expansion states, the premium increase differs significantly as well, with a 21% increase in non-expansion states and a 15% increase in states that have expanded Medicaid. Now, most people in ACA-compliant plans in the individual insurance market receive premium subsidies, and those subsidies increase dollar for dollar as premiums rise, protecting consumers in those plans. But the substantial number of people not eligible for these subsidies, which totals about 6.7 million people, could still find themselves vulnerable to increases depending on how states have approached it. Now, I think an example helps show how consumers may be affected. California is one of the states that have allowed premiums to increase only for silver plans in the marketplace. And this example shows how those increases will impact consumers. Silver premiums in California are going up a lot as a result of the end of the cost-sharing payments, from $378 for a 30-year-old per month to $425 in 2018. But the premiums for both bronze and gold plans are going up quite modestly. This example looks at a 30-year-old individual at 200% of the federal poverty level, about $24,000 in income. And this person would be eligible for both cost-sharing reductions and a premium subsidy. And you can see, comparing the benchmark silver plan, that's the second lowest cost silver plan, which is the basis for premium subsidies in 2017 and 2018, while the premium is going up substantially, what the individual would actually have to pay goes up hardly at all, from $127 a month to $130 a month, because the premium subsidy absorbs virtually the full increase in premiums. Now, this individual, because they are eligible for both reduced cost sharing and a premium subsidy, would likely want to stay in the Silver plan to get that cost sharing reduction. But for someone with income between 250 and 400% of the poverty level who is eligible for a premium subsidy but not a cost sharing subsidy, they may want to look at both bronze and gold plans. And you can see here, because of the effect of the increased premium subsidy tied to the increased silver premium, a bronze plan would be free for this person, although, of course, carry a higher deductible, and a gold plan would actually cost less than it does this year and have a much lower deductible. Now, full disclosure, this slide, which describes the elements of the Alexander Murray deal announced yesterday, was prepared last night. As of this morning, it's probably overstating things to say that there is bipartisan agreement on this deal. Talks are ongoing to help further stabilize the individual insurance market. And, you know, where this goes is unclear at this moment. The key elements, looking at the deal announced by Senators Alexander and Murray yesterday, could include guaranteeing cost-sharing payments to insurers through 2019, plus a mechanism to provide rebates to consumers and the federal government to reflect the fact that premiums have already increased, providing greater federal funding for outreach, expanding the availability of catastrophic or high-deductible plans, and giving states greater flexibility under ACA waivers. None of this will directly affect open enrollment, which begins in 2 weeks, but it could have significant effect on how insurers perceive the environment going forward and what happens to premiums. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jen and Karen to talk about what consumers need to be thinking about as open enrollment begins.
Great. Thanks, Larry. So regardless of what happens with Alexander Murray legislation, consumers with marketplace coverage are very worried about rising premiums and out-of-pocket costs. According to our latest Kaiser Health tracking poll, 6 in 10 marketplace enrollees worry that their cost sharing will become so high in 2018 they will not be able to afford the care they need. And over half are worried that premium increases will mean that they can no longer afford the plan that they have. Now, as Larry said earlier, most people purchasing coverage in the marketplaces will be protected from rising premiums because of the subsidies they receive. And premium pricing strategies in many states will also help those who are not eligible for subsidies. However, with all the changes in the markets across the country, it will be important for consumers to explore their plan options during the upcoming open enrollment period. At the same time, consumer awareness of key aspects of the ACA lags. The individual mandate remains in effect, yet 29% of the public and 4 in 10 uninsured believe the mandate was repealed or are unsure if the mandate remains in effect. Now, while most people say they would buy insurance even in the absence of the mandate, 44% of marketplace enrollees said that the mandate was a reason why they signed up for coverage. This uncertainty around the mandate, particularly among the uninsured, means they may be less motivated to explore potential coverage options. Now, of course, to satisfy the mandate, people can sign up for health coverage offered at work. They can apply for Medicaid or CHIP throughout the year, or they can apply for coverage in the marketplaces, but only during the upcoming open enrollment period. Unfortunately, most people are unaware or unsure of the timing of the open enrollment period. Only 4 in 10 marketplace enrollees and 15% of the uninsured correctly identified November 1st as the start of the open enrollment period, and even smaller shares correctly identified when it ends. This lack of awareness of when open enrollment ends is particularly problematic this year given the shortened open enrollment period. Consumers will have less time to apply for or renew their coverage, and those who wait may miss the deadline. Providing consistent reminders about key dates and information on where and how to enroll will be critical. However, ensuring the public is informed will be more difficult this year given reductions in federal advertising funding and in funding for federal navigators who play a key role in providing outreach and enrollment assistance to consumers. So we're counting on the media to some extent to fill in that important role in helping to educate the public And I'll now turn things over to Karen, who will share with you what consumers need to know.
Thanks, Jen. So I'm just going to quickly review a couple of things that, as we've heard, people may not know about but will be important for open enrollment to be a success. First, the dates of open enrollment. For people who buy coverage on their own, as Jen said, open enrollment is when you can do it. So if you don't sign up by the end of open enrollment, you won't be able to get coverage in 2018 in the non-group market unless you qualify for a special enrollment period. For the federal marketplace states, 39 states, open enrollment this year will start on November 1st and end on December 15th. That's 6 weeks sooner than it ended last year. States have the option when they run their own marketplace to extend those dates, and most of the state-based marketplaces have. But for everybody else, December 15th, midnight on December 15th, is the deadline for signing up. Now, for the past few years, the marketplace has automatically renewed people who were already in the marketplace for the coming year in their same plan if it was available. The auto-renewal happened if they had not acted by midnight on December 15th. And if people's plans were not going to be offered any longer in the coming year, the marketplace would auto-reassign you to a new plan. That auto-renewal and auto-reassignment practice will continue this year. Almost a quarter of marketplace enrollees were auto-renewed or auto-reassigned in 2017. So that will still be the case this year. That option will still be there, but consumers are strongly encouraged to not rely on auto-renewal but to actively renew this year. That means log into healthcare.gov, update your application for financial assistance, review your plan choices and what they cost, and then select a plan for 2018. If you want the same plan, select the same plan. But if you rely on auto-renewal, the marketplace may not provide you with the most accurate subsidies, and if you're reassigned to a plan, or it turns out it would be advantageous for you to pick a different plan, auto-renewal won't take care of that for you. Last year when people auto-renewed, if they woke up on January 2nd and realized they weren't happy with that plan choice or the price, they still had 4 more weeks of open enrollment left to pick a new plan, but that will not be the case this year. And also I would just mention, because the deadline for 2018 plan and rate filings was extended so late this year, some insurers have not yet seen their renewal notices, or some consumers, rather, have not yet seen renewal notices. Normally those would have arrived by now, so logging into healthcare.gov into your marketplace account will provide you with up-to-date information about what's happening with your plan next year and what the other plans will cost. Consumers need to know it is best to act early. Do not wait until the last minute. In all of the past open enrollments, there has been a surge of interest and activity as the deadline for open enrollment nears. But that increased activity always slows down the responsiveness of healthcare.gov. It has caused longer wait times on hold to the marketplace call center. And as we've learned in our surveys, some navigators and other in-person assister programs are unable to help all of the consumers who seek an appointment in that last week of open enrollment. In the past, HHS has allowed a so-called in-line extension of open enrollment for people who started their application but hadn't completed enrollment by midnight on the last day. So far, we haven't heard any word about whether in-line extensions will be granted for this open enrollment. HHS has announced that healthcare.gov will be taken offline for scheduled maintenance each Sunday during open enrollment, so that could slow things down as well. Again, for all these reasons, it is very important to get an early start on shopping for coverage this open enrollment. Now, some consumers may also encounter changes in eligibility and enrollment requirements this year, and there are two new rules that I'm going to quickly review. One is a new requirement that will take effect for the 2018 coverage year. Insurers now are permitted to refuse to effectuate 2018 coverage for consumers whom they covered in 2017 and who missed payments and still owe back due premiums. This change was allowed under the market stabilization regulation that HHS issued this spring. For 2018, this change should not affect that many people. Those who are at risk would be people who signed up during the second half of 2017 during a special enrollment opportunity and who then missed a premium payment on or after June 19th when this rule took effect. Now, insurers won't all do this. They have the option of not adopting this new practice, and states also have the option to prohibit it. But for consumers who encounter this barrier to enrollment, you can effectuate your 2018 coverage by repaying the premium debt to the issuer before the end of open enrollment. You can also sign up for coverage under a different insurance company if that is available to you. Now, if you dispute that you owe the back premiums, consumers need to know HHS has not yet established an appeals process for this change. So it's important to contact your state insurance regulator and the marketplace, and probably also to seek help from a trained navigator to wind your way through this process. The other change some consumers might encounter this year relates to something called failure to reconcile. Consumers who received premium tax credits in 2016 were required to file a 2016 federal income tax return this year, including Form 8962, in order to continue to be eligible for tax credits next year in 2018. Form 8962 is what the IRS requires people to use to reconcile their actual 2016 income with their estimated income on which their 2016 tax credit was based. This requirement has been phased in. Last year, if people didn't file their tax return, if people did file their tax return but didn't attach Form 8962, they could still sign up for coverage and subsidies. This year, both the return and Form 8962, this reconciliation form, are required. Now, what's tricky about this change is that people who are affected won't be told directly that failure to reconcile is the reason they can't get tax credits. Instead, the marketplace notice will simply say they are not eligible for premium tax credits in 2018, and it will provide a list of possible reasons why. Failure to reconcile will be on the list. So affected consumers will have to first figure out that this is the reason. Again, working with a trained navigator can help you figure this out. And then two, they'll have to file an amended return with Form 8962. Then they can update their marketplace account, and then they'll again be eligible for premium tax credits in 2018. Okay, last slide. Last but not least, just a reminder, consumers in 31 states and the District of Columbia need to know that Medicaid eligibility has been extended to adults with income at or below 138% of the federal poverty level. That's just over $16,000 a year for a single person, nearly $34,000 a year for a family of four. The Medicaid expansion accounts for most of the gains in health coverage in states that have adopted that. Medicaid is open year-round for enrollment, not just during open enrollment. But if people aren't sure what financial help they're eligible for in 2018, they can apply through the marketplace and find out whether they're eligible for Medicaid or tax credits that way. I think we'll stop there and take questions, but I just also wanted to remind our audience that we have developed a number of helpful resources for consumers and reporters related to open enrollment, including our health reform FAQs, our subsidy calculator, which will be updated shortly to reflect 2018 premiums and subsidies, and our state health facts data, which Jen directs with specific data about state marketplace enrollment, Medicaid eligibility, and other key information. So back to Craig.
Great. This is Craig again. That concludes the overview, and we will now turn to some of your questions. Just a reminder, you can type in your questions using the chat feature on your computer screen, hopefully, and we'll try to get to as many as we can in the time that remains. The first question comes from Donna Rosato of Consumer Reports. I think it has to do with the Alexander Murray bill or versions of it. If the cost-sharing reduction funding is restored, will insurers be able to keep the higher rates and benefits, or will double dipping be restricted? I know this likely varies by state, but what do you think will happen since most insurers did hike rates based on the risk of losing cost-sharing reduction funding? Larry, you want to take a crack at that?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, given that we're 2 weeks away from open enrollment, even if cost sharing reduction payments are restored, premiums are not going to change at this point. They'll be locked in for 2018. However, the Alexander Murray legislation, at least in draft form, required states to provide a mechanism to provide rebates to consumers and the federal government if the cost-sharing reduction payments are restored and the higher premiums are still in place. Now, interestingly, the federal government is actually bearing the brunt of the higher premiums through increased premium subsidies. So most of those rebates provided for in the Alexander Murray legislation would actually go to the federal government rather than to consumers. But at least in the draft legislation, this language is in brackets, so we have to assume that it's still being worked on.
Great, thank you. The next question is from Jesse Hellman at The Hill. Do you think the Trump administration's cuts to outreach and advertising is contributing to confusion about the individual mandate and open enrollment dates? Jen, is there...
Sure. Well, it's certainly not helping. What we know is that, you know, consumers need to hear this information over and over and over again. And so with the cuts to advertising and the lack of TV advertising means that fewer consumers are going to hear the messages. Fewer are going to be aware of the upcoming dates for the open enrollment period. And then with respect to the cuts to the Navigator funding, these are people on the ground who are out in the communities conducting outreach events and providing enrollment assistance. And with these cuts, many programs have had to cut back on their available staff, which means there will be fewer appointments and therefore fewer consumers who will be helped during open enrollment, and that many have cut back on the number of outreach events that they are able to do, particularly in advance of the open enrollment period. So again, I think there's a lot of confusion, a lot of mixed messages out there, and the reductions in advertising and in-person assistance funding are certainly contributing to that.
Thanks.
I have nothing to add. That's good. Thank you.
All right. The next question comes from Turner Cowles of Yahoo Finance. Is there data that shows the average premium and deductible increases nationwide across all plans? I think I could guess the answer, but Larry, you want to answer definitively?
The short answer is no. Most states do not make detailed information about premiums public until the start of open enrollment. In previous years, the federal government has released detailed data on premiums and plan details like deductibles and copays for all the plans that participate in healthcare.gov. And we're certainly expecting that data to become available this year as well. Generally, it's right around the beginning of open enrollment. So I don't think we'll get a complete picture of how much premiums are going up until just around the beginning of open enrollment. I mean, we know that premiums are increasing and that they're increasing in large part because of actions by the Trump administration, like terminating the cost-sharing subsidy payments. But until we see the actual data and consumers start getting their renewal notices, I don't think it's going to become quite completely tangible how much, in fact, premiums are going up.
Thanks. A related question about rates from Tammy Luby at CNN Money. Do you see any problems with insurers and states having enough time to plug rate data into healthcare.gov and state exchange sites? What about states that just changed their rates? And she cites Pennsylvania, Oregon, and Arkansas.
I would say, and Karen should jump in, but there will be some logistical challenges in getting healthcare.gov ready for open enrollment with premiums changing at this late date. But, you know, most of the hard work here is done by computers, not by, you know, gnomes. I think this should be possible.
Great. Another question from Ellen Freudenheim at the Huffington Post. With the cuts in Navigator services, website limitations, and other efforts to hobble, will people likely sign up for the wrong plans, and what would that look like?
I'll try that one. I think with the reductions in funding, both in advertising and for the Navigator programs, in-person assister programs, they are mostly continuing, although, as Jen mentioned, at a kind of reduced level, but they are mostly continuing, and I think they really are relying on earned media. They're relying on the press to help get the word out about this. I don't know if consumers might, make a mistake, if they are more likely to make a mistake or just not sign up or not sign up in time if they're not aware of all of these changes. Mostly in the past, what we've found is that people who seek in-person help from Navigators just don't have the confidence to go through this whole process on their own. It can be complicated to estimate your income, to accurately describe your family status and your household's tax status and all of these other things. And a lot of people who go through this do feel more comfortable if they have a trained professional kind of helping them. In addition to the Navigators, there are other in-person assister programs which are also continuing. Federally qualified health centers available in just about every community also provide enrollment assistance to people. They're still there. They're a little worried about their funding terminating this year, but they're still operational as well. And people can also, there are other volunteer assister programs. You can find help on findlocalhelp@healthcare.gov. So you can just plug in your zip code and that will give you the name of a Navigator or another trained marketplace assister. And many people continue to seek help from health insurance agents and brokers in signing up for coverage, and that's still available this year as well.
Great. We have a couple questions related to the healthcare.gov sign-up slowdowns and maintenance things. Donna Rosada at Consumer Reports asks, what does it mean for consumers when healthcare.gov is down for maintenance, just that they can't enroll? Can you still talk to someone? And then Tom Murphy at AP asks that you noted that healthcare.gov slows down at the end of the sign-up period. Does that affect all states or just the ones on the federal exchange? Karen, do you want to take a crack at those?
Sure. So when healthcare.gov is down, you can't go online to compare the plans that are available to you in that state, and you can't work on your application online. The call center is open, and you can work on an application through the call center. It's harder to have an operator describe all your plan choices over the phone and pick one. So for practical purposes, when healthcare.gov is down, it can be very difficult for people to work on their application and to compare plans and make a selection. So in terms of the slowdown, I don't know if Jen knows if that has been the experience in state-based marketplaces, if they have kind of more server capacity than the federal government does. But it has been true for the first four open enrollments on healthcare.gov that as you get toward the end of open enrollment or the end of or the middle of December, the website slows down. It'll freeze sometimes. Sometimes you'll get a message kind of kicking you off and saying, try again later. So that is just something to take into account. If you start this on December 14th, you may encounter just some technical difficulties in completing your application, selecting your plans, and enrolling.
Is that just the volume issue?
It's the volume issue.
And can I just add to that? This is Jen. So the planned outages for healthcare.gov obviously will only affect consumers in the states that rely on healthcare.gov as the application and enrollment portal. So in the state-based marketplaces, they will likely have their own schedule, but an entirely different schedule for when their systems may be offline for scheduled maintenance during the open enrollment period. But it's also important to note that in many states running their own marketplaces, they have extended the open enrollment period beyond December 15th. So while there will likely be planned outages for their websites as well, it may be a little bit less of an issue because of the extended open enrollment period in those states.
Great. One participant asked about the polling data that you cited and just wanting to know the dates of it and when we released it, which I think I can handle.
Yeah.
We just released that data this morning. You can find it on our homepage, kff.org. The dates of the data in it was from our September and October tracking polls. We pulled the two polls together so we could really look at what's happening in the uninsured and people with marketplace coverage. Then the next question is from Shen Liu at Magnify Money. Do you anticipate lower enrollment for 2018? Anyone want to take a crack at that? Volunteers?
This is Karen. Predictions are always hazardous. A lot of these changes and I think more importantly, the uncertainty and the sort of lack of awareness suggests that there could be a drop in enrollment as a result of this. We did see a drop-off in enrollment at the very end of open enrollment 4, just when the marketing ads were canceled at the last minute after January 20th, when the new administration took office. So I think there's a general expectation that without marketing, that marketing can help drive enrollment, that it can fall down. But people should also be aware when premiums are going up that their subsidy dollars will go up and can go farther and may even improve affordability for some people. So that's why it really is important to get the word out to take a look at what your plan choices and costs are and maybe even be pleasantly surprised.
All right. Thank you. Another question from Steve Jordan at the Omaha World Herald. Any sign that companies would re-enter the marketplaces if the Murray plan is approved, or is it too late? Larry, you want to take a crack?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that at this point it's too late for insurers to re-enter the market for 2018. I mean, it's theoretically possible that open enrollment could be delayed and insurers could be allowed to refile premiums and participation, but that seems highly unlikely. I think the Alexander Murray, I think any congressional any bipartisan deal in Congress is more about providing further stability to the marketplace going forward in 2019 and beyond. And the truth is, 2019 will be upon us before we know it, particularly for actuaries and insurance companies who will be starting to work on 2019 premiums right after the first of the year, and they have to be filed to states beginning in the spring.
Great. Thank you very much. Robert Lowes of Medscape is looking for a rundown of the enrollment numbers from 2014 through 2017, and also if we could clarify whether we're using sign-ups effectuated enrollment numbers or year-end numbers. I don't know if anyone has those handy.
This is Jen. I don't have all of the actual numbers handy, but when looking at signups during the open enrollment period, we did see a steady increase in enrollment from the first open enrollment period through the 2016 open enrollment period. As Karen already mentioned, the enrollment or the signups dropped off last year or during the 2017 open enrollment period, in part because of the new administration coming in and cuts to the advertising budget, so we didn't see the typical surge in enrollment at the end of January that we had seen in previous years. The effectuated enrollment has been somewhat spotty, and so the only available data is from February of 2017. And prior to that, we had effectuated enrollment from March of 2016. So those data are fairly spotty. I can certainly follow up with you with a compilation of the data that we have.
And this is Karen. Just in terms of the end of open enrollment numbers, I think in the first open enrollment, we had 8 million people who had signed up for coverage. That always drops off a little bit in terms of how many effectuate coverage a month or two later. In the second open enrollment, it grew to 11.7 million. In the third open enrollment, 12.7 million. And then last year, it dropped off a little bit. It was on a track to exceed 12.7 million, but then the marketing ads were canceled for the last 10 days of open enrollment, and we ended up, I think, at 12.2 million. So that's been the trajectory so far year at the end of open enrollment.
Okay. A question from Jeannie on Yahoo Finance. Will there be any changes to the penalties incurred for not having coverage? Karen?
This is Karen. The penalties are the same in 2018. So the penalty is the greater of $695 for an adult who's uninsured for the whole year, or 2.5% of your household income above the tax filing threshold. For 2017, that was $10,400 for a single individual. So the penalties are the same. They're fully phased in now, and that's what they are.
Great. Another question, what should consumers do if their insurers left the marketplace? I think you touched on that, Karen, but...
Sure. So if your insurer left the marketplace, there are other insurers offering coverage on the marketplace for 2018. We don't foresee any bear counties where no insurers are offering any plans. So if your insurer left the marketplace, you probably did receive a notice by now from the insurer saying they're not coming back. And so you will need to go to the marketplace and see who else is offering coverage, look at those plans, and then sign up for one of those. If you don't act by December 15th, the marketplace, for most people, will look using algorithms at the plans that are offered, try to pick the one that is most similar to the one you had, and automatically sign you up for that.
Okay. Another question from Jane Saracen Khan. I think this is really, what is the status of the CHIP reauthorization bill? Does anyone feel like they can speak to CHIP? Okay.
It has. Sure. This is Jen. It has not yet been reauthorized. I don't know whether there's the plans for voting on it, but we are... you know, we do know that CMS has had to send additional money from the unallocated CHIP funds to several states, including Minnesota and Arizona, I believe, because they are running out of funds. So it is important that Congress act, but I don't have the latest update.
I'm sorry, we can't help more on that on this call. A question from Antonia Devota. What are the challenges for insurers seeking to comply with Trump's executive order as well as various state-mandated benefits and laws? So sort of, I guess, the question about the challenges insurers have of planning for what might be changing. Larry, you want to take a crack?
Sure. Well, I would say there are both challenges and opportunities for insurers with the president's executive order. But it's important to keep in mind that the executive order is quite vague and directs federal agencies to consider changes to regulations and guidance, but doesn't provide any specific proposed changes. So there are a lot of open questions about how the resulting regulations would really work. I mean, a couple observations. One around association health plans. These association health plans provided to small businesses and potentially self-employed people as well would be treated essentially as large employer plans, so would be exempt from many of the rules under the ACA, including community rating and the essential benefits requirements. So these association health plans provide an opportunity for plans to cherry pick healthy people and would leave the regulated small business market with a much more expensive pool of people to cover and higher premiums as a result. There would be a significant challenge for insurers still operating in that regulated part of the market to offer stable premiums. And similarly with short-term plans, these short-term plans could deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, charge some higher premiums, and offer skimpier coverage. That also offers an opportunity for plans to cherry-pick healthy people and leave the individual market with a sicker pool of people to cover. A big question with the short-term plans is whether the individual mandate penalty would still apply for people who enroll in these short-term plans. Right now, those plans don't qualify as minimum coverage, so anyone buying a short-term insurance plan also has to pay the individual mandate penalty. If the penalty is waived as part of any implementation of the executive order, these short-term plans could really take off, offering cheaper coverage to healthy people, but sicker people would find themselves potentially priced out of the market.
Thanks, Larry. A question, a simple one. What is the total enrollment in the exchanges for 2017? I think Karen mentioned.
What are we at now? 10 point. The latest data that have been released are, as Jen mentioned, were from February. And then effectuated enrollment was?
At 10.3 million.
Jen's Googling it 10. Now.
10.3 million, I believe.
Yeah, and in figure 7 in our chart shows that effectuated enrollment.
Great. So figure 7 is coming right up. We're working on it. There it is. Sorry about that. Or go back one. So that has the total is the 1.6 plus the 8.7. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. About 10.3 is what that with rounding. Ellen Fordenheim at Huffington Post has another question. With all the cuts to, I guess, outreach and advertising, has anyone predicted the number of people who won't enroll due to missing the deadline? Confusion, et cetera. We don't have a prediction. Does anyone know of other estimates? No, unfortunately, we don't have an estimate or a prediction.
No, I would add, this is Larry, in the past, the Department of Health and Human Services has publicly issued a projection for enrollment, but they have not done so this year.
Good point. Thanks, Larry. Steve Jordan at the Omaha World Herald again. How many waivers are pending like Iowa's? So I think this is a Section 1332 waiver. Is that the right waiver?
Yes.
Jen, you want to answer that?
Yes, this is Jen. So current waivers pending with HHS are the Iowa waiver and also a waiver submitted by the state of Oregon to do a reinsurance program similar to what Alaska has done. Earlier, back in at the end of September, Oklahoma, which had been waiting on approval of its 1332 waiver, which was also a reinsurance waiver, actually withdrew their waiver application after the administration failed to approve the waiver in by the deadline that the state needed in order to submit the 2018 rates for insurers, but currently Iowa is pending, as is Oregon, and the federal comment, the required mandatory federal comment period for the Iowa waiver ends tomorrow, and the comment period ended for the Oregon waiver on October 11th.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sort of a general question about the issues consumers will face. What do you imagine being the most complicated things consumers will face during open enrollment this year, especially in states without expanded Medicaid and with state governments that have not been invested in the ACA success since the start?
Sure. So some of the new rules that I described, I think, could perplex people if they do encounter those for the first time. Otherwise, I think just in some states, Ohio, for example, it may be much harder for people to find in-person assistance, the largest and only statewide navigator program in that state, closed down as a result of the funding reductions and is not being replaced. So I think health centers and one other small regional navigator program will continue to work in that state, but it could be harder for people to find help, and that could create complications. So otherwise, I don't know sort of what the state of sort of anti-ACA marketing may be by state officials who oppose the law, but that could also add to confusion for residents of those states who may not be aware of all of these changes that we've just talked about today, including the change in the deadline for signing up.
Thank you, Karen. There are a couple questions about the polling data and looking for additional breakdowns in terms of whether state-facilitated and federally-facilitated marketplaces. I don't think we have the ability to break it down that way. Do check out the full poll report, though, which does have some additional breakdowns of including, I think, people in the non-group market broadly and some total population data. So do look for that there. Jumping back to the Alexander Murray plan that was announced, a deal that was announced yesterday, we have a question. What is the timeline for a vote on the deal, and is it likely to be folded into some other piece of legislation? Larry, want to try to crack?
Well, I think, as Karen said earlier, predictions are hard, or paraphrasing Yogi Berra, predictions about the future are particularly hard. And maybe predictions about the future in Congress right now are especially difficult. So I would hesitate I don't think there is, as far as I know, there is no timeline. And I think with developments this morning, there's continuing discussions about what might even be in the deal, or if there even is a deal.
Yeah. Thanks, Larry. I think when you were talking earlier in your presentation, you mentioned that one state did not allow cost increases for the loss of CSRs, and we have a question, which state was that?
Yeah, the one state we know of is North Dakota, but the Blue Cross plan there, the major insurer, has indicated that they will stay in the market even though they will not be allowed to increase premiums to compensate for the loss of cost-sharing reduction payments.
Okay, I think we're nearing the end of our time. Hopefully we can get a couple more questions. This one comes from David Hood at SNL Financial. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners is investigating at least two companies that have marketed their STLD plans as ACA compliant, and he wants to know if the executive order might complicate that investigation and litigation. Do we know what that's in reference to, and can anyone speak to if we know of any implications?
Go ahead, Karen.
I think we were going to say the same thing. I don't know about the details of the NAIC investigation. STLD is the short-term limited duration policies, which the executive order did direct the agencies to sort of expand access to. So I think usually it would not be the case that a change would, you know, have a retroactive effect to someone that was breaking the rules before that, but I can't really say. Sorry.
And I would just add here, as we mentioned, the short-term plans currently are not considered minimum coverage for the purposes of the individual mandate, and that has to be disclosed clearly by insurers that are selling these plans now.
Thanks, Larry. The last question, I think, is going to be a short one. Are folks looking at the impact of the insurance gyrations on access to care or medical and clinical practice? I know that we're not. Does anyone know of people who actively are looking? No?
Jen? This is Jen. So it's hard to know what impact all of these changes and the upheavals will have on access to care. I mean, we do know that simply having an insurance card doesn't guarantee people access to care and doesn't mean that they will be able to get the care that they need, but it certainly does help. One issue that consumers will face is with the changes in the markets and with many consumers having to switch plans, they will likely have to enroll in plans with different provider networks and may be also required to change providers and to find new doctors. And that can be very disruptive for consumers and creates delays in people being able to access the care that they need. So I think we're, you know, it's a little too early to know exactly how this is going to affect the ability of people to get the care they need, but, you know, it certainly may have an effect.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. I think that's going to conclude today's web briefing. As I said earlier, we will post an archived version of this and all the slides online later today or tomorrow at kff.org. We'll notify you all where to find them once they are live on the site. Thanks again for participating and for all your questions. If you have questions that we weren't able to get to, please reach out to my colleague, Katie Smith. You'll see her contact information on the screen, and she will help track down answers for you. Thanks again, and have a great day.